Hello, and welcome to Silver Threads, a weekly program of information on how you can make your senior year shine. I'm Kathy Van Skoik. You might not automatically think of elders when you hear about the opioid crisis, yet older people are connected in a variety of ways, as addicts themselves, as parents and grandparents of addicts, and shockingly, often as illicit providers. Today's articles offer information on how elders participate in the crisis in each of those functions. They include, from the Huffington Post, Beyond Addiction, How Older People Are Forgotten in the Opioid Crisis, January 2018, AARP Bulletin's The Opioid Medicare Connection, April 2018, and Older Americans Are Selling Their Prescription Painkillers on to Drug Pushers, and The Faces of Addiction, both from June of 2017. And finally, from Science Daily, Medical Cannabis Significantly Safer for Elderly with Chronic Pain than Opioids, February 2018. And I'll begin with the Huffington Post. It would be easy to look at the steady stream of reporting on the opioid crisis and conclude that the problem is all about addiction. Certainly, the cost in lives lost has been unacceptably high, more than 183,000 deaths in the last 10 years. But the opioid crisis is a story of many kinds of pain, and it's about more than addiction. What is getting lost is the impact this epidemic is having on a wide circle of people who are not addicted. It is affecting people in every age group: children, parents, grandparents, and entire communities, particularly small and rural communities. It is creating chaos in communities that are struggling to cope with the fallout in child welfare, elder abuse, public safety, criminal justice, the workforce, the economy, caregiving, housing, and of course, health care. There's no question we need to work together on solutions, but whether we are health care providers, policymakers, communities, or funders, we first need to widen the lens we are using to consider the problem. A problem that's getting older. The needs and concerns of older people very rarely get any attention in discussions about the opioid problem. This needs to change for several reasons. While older people do not have the highest rate of opioid-related deaths, that age group hardest hit is adults 45 to 54, they are far from immune. There is also emerging evidence that Medicare patients have some of the highest and fastest growing rates of opioid use disorder, UOD, with hospitalizations increasing by 10% per year. Younger people struggling with these drugs now are likely to have problems throughout their lives. So we can predict a large cohort of older people with an opioid history in the coming years. Most importantly, one need not be addicted to be hurt. Older people are often drawn into the struggles of addicted children, friends, and extended family. The growing number of grandparents raising the children of addicted parents in grand families has paralleled the growth of the epidemic, according to Generations United. Many older people are also desperate to keep a struggling family member afloat. Too often, the result of these valiant efforts to hold a family together is older members going down with the ship. By sheltering an addicted child or grandchild in public housing, an older adult risks eviction under anti-drug use regulations from the Department of Housing and Urban Development. Their personal safety may also be at risk. A rise in elder abuse and financial exploitation is attributed to the opioid crisis, as more adult children with addiction problems move back in with their parents. Older people's concerns must be part of a comprehensive solution, including support for those who take on responsibilities such as raising grandchildren, elder abuse and mistreatment, and offering efforts on stronger prevention and intervention. High rates of chronic pain and the scarcity of good alternatives to opioids for treatment, and the reluctance to seek help that many older people feel due to cultural and generational sensitivities. Remembering rural needs. Small towns and rural places, home to about 1 out of 4 older Americans, are feeling some of the worst impact. Rural communities tend to be cohesive and self-reliant, but their infrastructure and resources are often limited, and they are frequently overlooked, a dangerous mix when it comes to opioids. Once again, the harm to people in rural America is not limited to addiction, so the solutions for these communities can't be limited to this either. Chronic pain and the unintended consequences of reform. The medical community has begun to respond, in part by rethinking prescribing practices and limiting access to opioids. This is an important step, since leftover medications often fall into the wrong hands and cause trouble. It is just as important to note, however, that chronic pain is a legitimate problem, particularly for a high percentage of older people and for rural residents who may have suffered work-related injuries from physically demanding jobs like coal mining and farming. For that reason, sweeping restrictions on opioid access are not being universally cheered by geriatricians. I think the policies and procedures we are putting in place are going to increase the well-established and sizable number of older people who do not have pain adequately treated, said Carrie Reed, MD, PhD, and Director of the Office of Geriatric Research in the Division of Geriatrics and Palliative Medicine at Weill Cornell Medical College, and Director of Cornell's Translational Research Institute on Pain in Later Life. We need to recognize that the line between palliative care and chronic disease care can be blurry in older patients. Clearly, this need cannot be ignored. A concern echoed in a new study, Pain Management and the Opioid Epidemic, Balancing Societal and Individual Benefits and Risks of Prescription Opioid Use, from the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine. This epidemic offers numerous entry points for funders of all kinds and sizes. The potential for meaningful impact is great, in part because, surprisingly, little has been done so far. Because the problem is multisystemic and many communities are overwhelmed, it is unusually important for funders to take the initiative, says Alan Smart, who worked on the opioid problem while vice president of programs and interim president at the Kate B. Reynolds Charitable Trust and now serves as project director for a study on rural philanthropy practice at Campbell University in North Carolina. Funders are in a unique position to listen, digest, and bring the best thinking to the table because of our broad interest in rural communities. One resource funders can consult to get started is Heartache, Pain, and Hope, Rural Communities, Older People, and the Opioid Crisis, an Introduction for Funders. The guide can help funders become familiar with the issue and offers descriptions of a wide range of programs that are already working, including the National Family Caregiver Support Program and Kinship Navigator Programs to help grand families get the full range of legal and financial options, information, and support that they need. Programs like IAMNDN, which builds intergenerational ties between Native American elders and youth to help combat the culture of drug abuse, and counseling services tailored to the needs and preferences of older people, such as Senior Hope Counseling in Albany, New York, and TelePain Consults, which use telemedicine to connect providers from rural, tribal, and medically underserved areas with pain medicine specialists. To tackle such a large and multifaceted problem, we must widen our lens and consider the needs of all people swept up in it. It's the only way we can take meaningful progress meeting the needs of both individuals and communities in pain. And now, The Opioid Medicare Connection by Joe Eden. Medicare numbers are worth more on the black market than credit card numbers, said Michael Cohen of the Office of Inspector General at HHS. That has been especially true in recent years, as Medicare ID numbers have been abused to fuel the ongoing opioid crisis. Shady doctors are writing bogus prescriptions for opioid painkillers using Medicare numbers that have been stolen or bought from their holders. The pills are then sold on the street for huge profits. The practice is shockingly common, and the impact is severe. For Medicare, it means covering the cost of countless millions of high-priced pills that never should have been prescribed. At the same time, prescription opioids are responsible for an estimated 95 overdose deaths a day in the United States. Drugs are stolen from the program and they end up on the streets, Cohen says. Sometimes the 20-year-old you see on the news overdosed on a Medicare drug. Monitoring opioid prescriptions is hard because they are so frequently given to patients in pain. One in three Medicare Part D beneficiaries received at least one prescription opioid in 2016, according to the Office of Inspector General. Roughly 70,000 of them received what the office calls extreme amounts, meaning far beyond the recommended maximum usage. Consider the case of Compassionate Doctors, a Detroit-area medical clinic that appeared to be a legitimate health practice. But in reality, Sardar Ashrafkhan, the physician who ran the practice, used recruiters to round up Medicare beneficiaries and bring them, or at least their Medicare ID numbers, to his office. Ashrafkhan then wrote prescriptions for opioids, including oxycodone and hydrocodone, in their names. The patients were usually paid in cash or drugs for the use of their Medicare numbers. The recruiters then filled the prescriptions at pharmacies and sold the drugs directly on the street at a high markup. Ashrafkhan, who was sentenced to 23 years in prison in 2017 for his role in the scam, illegally sold more than 1 2/10 million doses of addictive opioids, prosecutors said. Investigators say insurers, and particularly Medicare, must find ways to identify scam doctors like him. This is happening in every city and every state across the country, said Charlie Sichan, executive director of the National Association of Drug Diversion Investigators. Insurance fraud is fueling the opioid epidemic, and that leads to overdose deaths. And now older Americans are selling their prescription painkillers to drug pushers, by Joe Eaton. Over a span of about 2 years, Ajalon Dido, a 29-year-old drug dealer, sold thousands of prescription painkillers on the illicit drug market near Sacramento, California. Finding customers was easy. The hard part was finding a supply of pills. A reliable source? Older people, Dido said in an email sent from federal prison in Arizona, where he is serving a 12-year sentence on drug charges. They want to make some extra money and don't mind selling the pills. Interviews with law enforcement members across the country, along with a review of court cases, confirm that retirement-age Americans have become a new source of illicit prescription painkillers sold on the open market. Some sell their pills due to a financial crisis or to make ends meet. Others are victims of drug dealers who target them for their prescriptions. And in some cases, caregivers and family members are pilfering their medications for profit or to feed their own addictions. What helps fuel this troubling trend is not just the poverty faced by some older people, it's also their ability to easily gain prescriptions from doctors. If they discover they can make $20 a pill on the street, then it becomes a temptation to supplement their income, according to Sichan. While there are no precise statistics to gauge the size of the problem, law enforcement officials from New York to Los Angeles say that older people selling prescription medication is a real issue. The reason for the lack of data? Federal prosecutors focus their efforts on large-scale opioid pushers. And local prosecutors say there is a reluctance to prosecute people at or near retirement age for selling their relatively small cache of prescription drugs. These factors have allowed the problem to remain below the radar. But treatment workers and researchers who study addiction say the prescription drugs of older Americans often end up on the open market. We know that some elderly patients use their prescriptions as a strategy for increasing income, said Sharon Walsh, director of the University of Kentucky Center for Drug and Alcohol Research in Lexington. Walsh said older Americans who sell their prescriptions do not operate like traditional drug dealers. Instead, they sell and sometimes share their medications through a network of friends and family members, often without good understanding of the dangers or potential legal consequences. People, especially in rural communities, they don't see anything wrong with selling or sharing prescription medications, Walsh said. It's a culturally accepted thing to supply medication to a person who is in pain. Prosecution uncommon, sentences light. In January, a 74-year-old woman in Kingsport, Tennessee, was sentenced to probation for selling prescription pain pills after police seized more than 100 oxycodone pills and cash from her home. Kent Chitwood, the assistant district attorney who prosecuted the case, said about 1 in 10 of the prescription drug cases he prosecutes involve an older adult. Some may have economic reasons why they chose to sell their drugs, Chitwood said. Others have long histories and continue to do these things until their elderly years. Prosecutions are challenging because juries are surprised to see an older person on trial, and judges are reluctant to give jail time, law enforcement officials say. Captain Jeff Orr, president of the Ohio Task Force Commanders Association, said for older drug sellers who are caught, it's often their first brush with the law. If we get information about sellers, we are following up on it. Are they going to prison for it? No, Orr said. They are being diverted to probation at that age. Austin Serb, a convicted drug dealer in Boise, Idaho, said he knew many older people who sold their prescriptions. A patient who is prescribed 3 pills a day can make up to $3,600 a month selling them, Serb said. It's too tempting, especially if they need the money, Serb wrote from federal prison in Colorado. Once they do it, they keep doing it. Captain Steve Arthur of the Baldwin County Sheriff's Office in Alabama said he sees few cases in which older people set out to sell drugs. More often, drug dealers recruit them either with threats or promises of money to get prescriptions that they later sell at a steep markup. And in some cases, fraudulent or careless prescribing has left older patients with more opioid pills than they need. The flow of opioids from older Americans to the street isn't always at a profit. Pills often are stolen by home health workers, taken from medicine cabinets by family members and visitors, and sometimes just given away. But for drug dealers like Dudeau, older Americans will continue to provide an irresistible opportunity to secure the profitable pills. The old lady next door might be a great supplier, he says. And now the faces of addiction. Bo Maxey. It was soon after he retired in 2006 while golfing that Bo Maxey, 63, first felt the twinge in his lower back. He began creating the pain, treating it with the opioid Lortab. His prescription was for one pill every 4 hours, but soon he was taking two or three every 2 hours, and he couldn't bear to be without them. When the addiction kicks in, you lie, he says. It becomes a way of life and increasing bad behavior. Maxey of Atlanta began a 10-year cycle of using opioids, then overusing alcohol to kick the pills, then going back to opioids. The toll on his family was devastating. Last October, after being hospitalized from a bad fall that followed a bout of heavy drinking, he checked into a drug rehabilitation center. I felt like an embarrassment, a failure, he says. I had hurt my family, my friends, and myself. It cost me my marriage. As of this writing, Maxie has been sober for 7 months. It's so easy and innocent and quick to get hooked, he says. There should be a huge warning label on those pill bottles that says highly addictive. That from John Rosengren. And Laura Thompson. A car accident in 2001 began a years-long cycle of despair for Laura Thompson, who fell deep into addiction to pain pills and then had to battle back. The Chico, California woman began her descent by simply following doctor's orders. "I had a lot of respect for the medical field. Maybe too much respect," said Thompson, 64. "I looked at doctors as God figures, and I think I was too trusting." Thompson chased relief from neck pain through multiple prescriptions. Then in 2007, she underwent spinal surgery and was prescribed fentanyl, a synthetic opioid that is about 80 times more powerful than morphine. The drug proved dangerously seductive. In 2008, she checked into an addiction treatment facility. "I thought I was going through hell," she says. "I felt like my whole body was turning inside out." Next, her husband got her into a rehab facility in Newport Beach. That proved to be a turning point. Thompson hasn't abused prescription painkillers since 2008. She still attends Pill Anonymous meetings, but has agreed to give up her anonymity, a strong tradition in 12-step programs, to help others struggling with addiction. "I want people to know there is hope and there is a solution." That from Joe Eaton. And finally, from Science Daily, medical cannabis significantly safer for elderly with chronic pain than opioids. A new study found cannabis therapy is safe and efficacious for elderly patients who are seeking to address cancer symptoms, Parkinson's disease, post-traumatic stress disorder, ulcerative colitis, Crohn's disease, multiple sclerosis, and other medical issues. After 6 months, more than 18% of patients surveyed had stopped using opioid analgesics and had reduced their dosage. That from researchers at Ben-Gurion University of the Negev BGU and the Cannabis Clinical Research Institute at Soroconul University Medical Center. While older patients represent a large and growing population of medical cannabis users, few studies have addressed how it affects this particular group, which also suffers from dementia, frequent falls, mobility problems, and hearing and visual impairments, said Professor Victor Novak, MD, a professor of medicine at the BGU Faculty of Health Sciences and head of Soroka Cannabis Clinical Research Institute. "After monitoring patients 65 and older for 6 months, we found medical cannabis treatment significantly relieves pain and improves quality of life for seniors with minimal side effects reported. This older population represents a growing segment of medical cannabis, ranging from approximately 7% to more than 33%, depending on the country." BGU researchers surveyed 2,736 patients 65 years and older who received medical cannabis through Tikkun Olam, the largest Israeli medical cannabis supplier. More than 60% were prescribed medical cannabis due to pain, particularly pain associated with cancer. After 6 months of treatment, more than 93% of the 901 respondents reported their pain dropped from a median of 8 to 4 on a 10-point scale. Close to 60% of patients who originally reported bad or very bad quality of life upgraded to good or very good after 6 months. And more than 70% of patients surveyed reported moderate to significant improvement in their condition. The most commonly reported adverse effects were dizziness and dry mouth. After 6 months, more than 18% of patients surveyed had stopped using opioid analgesics or had reduced their dosage. All patients received a prescription after consulting with a doctor who prescribed treatment. More than 33% of patients used cannabis-infused oil. Approximately 24% inhaled therapy by smoking, and approximately 6% used vaporization. While the researchers state their findings to date indicate cannabis may decrease dependence on prescription medicines, including opioids, more evidence-based data from this special aging population is imperative. Well, the first article struck a chord with me about how the families of addicts suffer serious consequences as a result of an addicted family member. Without using her name, I can relate the story of how a heroin addiction affected a close family friend of mine and her extended family. Her son began using alcohol and marijuana as a teenager and soon graduated to harder drugs and finally became a heroin addict. Once discovered, my friend sought help and was directed to Al-Anon. It was difficult, but because it caused such upheaval in the family, my friend and her husband had to tell her son to leave the home. He had always had a close relationship with his widowed grandmother. My friend's ex-husband's mother and the boy continued to see her often until she made a distressing discovery. Her grandson had stolen several $1,000s from her using a credit card. She was angry, heartbroken, and confused. She sought help from an addictions counselor and was encouraged to gather family to do an intervention with the grandson. As difficult as it was for her, she had to tell the grandson that she would press charges, which would ultimately mean jail time, unless he would agree to go to treatment. The story, unlike many, has a positive ending. Her grandson agreed to go, finished treatment successfully, and has stayed free of drugs and become a productive member of society. Over time, he was able to mend the damaged relationship with his grandmother and even became part of her caregiving team when she needed additional care. His relationships with parents and siblings improved as well. It's a lesson for me that very few families are exempt from being affected by the opioid crisis. It weaves its web, impacting all geographic locations, cultures, ages, genders, and socioeconomic groups. We all need to widen the lens and consider the needs of all who are swept up in it. We must all be part of the solution. Thanks for listening today, and until next week, I'm Kathy Van Skoik. You've been listening to Silver Threads, a production of WXXI Reach Out Radio in Rochester, New York. The audio producer for the show is Maureen Rich, and I'm Kathy Van Skoik. I hope you will join me again next week for more information and updates for making the best of your silver years. If you'd like to hear this program again, you can download a podcast of the show at our website, wxxi.org.